Hi everyone, Sam here. Thank you so much for listening to the Policy Dispatch. Before we dive in, if you want to enjoy premium access to the podcast and want to read or listen to the unmissable and informative journalism from Foresight Climate and Energy, make sure to subscribe. You can try us for 30 days for less than €1 a day, which will give you access to our website and app. Just follow the link in the show notes or go to www.foresightdk.com/subscribe to find out more. Hello and welcome to this, the latest episode of the Policy Dispatch, courtesy of Foresight Climate and Energy. I'm your host, Sam Morgan. Air travel has made the world a smaller place for more of humankind than at any point in history, but it is also helping to make the world a warmer place, thanks to the climate impact of jet planes. Aviation carbon emissions account for more than 2% of the globe's total, meaning it ranks among the world's biggest emitters. Take into account non-CO2 and that share goes up further still. Unlike road transport, where decarbonisation options are now blindingly obvious, it is less clear what the future holds for air travel. Technology needs to be developed, scaled up and deployed if emission-free flight is to go from utopian dream to ubiquitous reality. That requires, you guessed it, policies. Today's episode will look into what is needed to move airlines away from polluting kerosene. Now, before we kick off this dispatch, a quick quiz for you. According to the United Nations, if aviation were a country, which of the following nations would it equal in terms of CO2 pollution? Is it Brazil, Canada, or Germany? Stay tuned to find out the answer at the end of the show. So, what are governments doing to incentivize low-carbon flight? And what is the outlook in general for green aviation? To make sense of all this and more, I'm joined today by Joe Darden, who heads up aviation policy at Clean Mobility Group, Transport and Environment. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the Policy Dispatch. Thank you for joining us. You're our fourth guest, so welcome to the show.
Hi, Sam. Pleasure to be here.
Excellent. So we're going to be talking all about aviation today, your specialist subject.
Indeed.
I guess we kick off with aviation was probably one of the most visibly affected sectors, shall we say, during the COVID pandemic. You know, the skies were clear and there were all these headlines about how flights were cancelled, would it recover and everything. What is the sort of state of play now? Has it had a permanent impact on, number of flights, or are we recovering to like a pre-pandemic level? What's the sort of state of play there? Mm.
So in terms of current state of flights and emissions, so indeed, as you said, in 2020, you know, airline pollution fell quite significantly because most of the flights were grounded, most of the planes were grounded, stuck on the tarmac. So I think airline pollution in 2020 plummeted by 64% in total. But then gradually traffic started back up again. And I think this year was, let's say, the best year since COVID for EU airlines. I think we're close to 90% of traffic compared to pre-COVID levels. So in a sense, we are seeing traffic bouncing back. And I think some issues that we all have seen over the summer holidays, you know, some airlines and some parts of the industry struggling to deal with bumped up demand and dealing with also the aftermath of COVID and the impact that it had on staff and employment. We're seeing traffic bounce back, I think mostly on let's say more domestic intra-EU markets. I think on some international routes, traffic is still, let's say, lower. I think because mainly some third countries still have, especially in Asia, still have some strict, traveling requirements. But what we hear from the industry is that they're expecting a full recovery to 2019 levels by 2024. So we'll continue seeing, let's say, traffic bounce back, maybe not equally across all airlines, but at least in general in the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's kind of interesting to look back on that 2020 period where for so many things to do with energy and climate and transport, there was a little bit of optimism from certain people about how problems like emissions would be taken care of by the pandemic. You know, there would not be a return to business as normal. But I guess from what you're saying, the aviation sector is returning to the point it was at. I mean, what kind of policies then are in place, are going to be in place in Europe and around the world that
aim to bring down aviation emissions, regulate them, manage them, and so on? What are the big flagship policies?
Maybe just before then, bouncing back on what you just said in terms of the emissions coming back to, you know, pre-COVID levels in 2024, that's kind of what we said already in 2020. Mm-hmm. When flights were grounded, we said, you know, the aviation sector, of course, maybe this crisis is bigger than the ones that the aviation sector has known in the past. But, you know, we had the terrorist attacks. There was also this volcano eruption back in, I think, 2016. So, you know, the aviation sector has always known these, let's say, spontaneous or, little moments of little phases of reduced traffic or because of economic turmoil or other reasons. But the thing is that the aviation sector always bounces back, mostly because it is under-regulated and overly subsidized. Mm-hmm. And we saw that during the COVID pandemic as well. Lufthansa, Air France, other big airlines, not just in Europe, but also in the world, in the US, in Asia as well, receiving huge bailout packages to try and save them from basically
bankruptcy,
losing bankruptcy. Exactly. So saving airlines from bankruptcy by continuing to finance them, but without any proper conditions on building back better and being greener. And we have seen, and I have to be quite positive sometimes, but we have seen airlines since COVID change their narrative a bit. Mm-hmm. So focusing a bit more on not just whether they can decarbonize, but when and which pathway to use. And I think that's an interesting shift because they understand now that they can't do whatever they want anymore and that governments are rightly so, thinking about regulating the sector a bit more and addressing emissions and, you know, the unfair treatment that airlines and the aviation sector as a whole have been benefiting from over the past decades. Mm-hmm. And so to come on your question about the regulation around the sector globally, to deal with aviation's environmental impact, there is practically none, I have to be honest. I mean, the main, let's say, body in charge of dealing with aviation emissions at the global level is the UN agency called ICAO, so this International Civil Aviation Organization. And ICAO was a great institution at the start to deal with aviation safety rules, security, air traffic rights. So it played a huge role in trying to liberalize basically the aviation market, making it easier for flights to go from different points in the world. Mm-hmm. And for that, of course, you had to have proper safety rules, security rules, you know, recognizing the different security standards across the world. So ICAO fundamentally was set up to promote and protect the industry. So now that it was tasked maybe a few decades ago with the objective of also dealing with the sector's environmental impact, that's when it went pear-shaped because fundamentally you have transport ministries sitting around a table trying to discuss how to address aviation's climate impact. And it is counterintuitive to the duty of a transport minister that is to promote and protect its industry. So we end up with policies that are way too weak in principle, but also in practice. And one of the main policies that you have, is CORSIA. So this carbon offsetting scheme that the ICAO, I think, adopted back in 2016 after pressure from the EU to regulate aviation emissions on long-haul flights. ICAO came up with a scheme, which basically is a cheap offsetting scheme that allows aviation emissions to continue growing. And that's one of the issues as well at the ICAO level is that you have 193 states sitting around a table. And among those, you have those developed countries that have been enjoying, let's say, freedom of circulation, freedom of growing their own industry for decades. And then you have developing countries like India, China, Brazil, that are starting to see their industry grow and feel that it's unfair that they carry the burden of the climate impact of all these flights that have been happening in the developed world.
Right.
So the solution was to come up with an offsetting scheme that basically forces airlines to buy a certain level of offsets or a certain number of offsets to compensate for the growth in their emissions according to a specific baseline. So as I just said, they're offsetting growth and not actual emissions. So if you grow, you know, fast, then you have to maybe offset more. If you grow less fast, you'll offset less. But in total, you're not covering your actual emissions, but only mm-hmm. the growth. And when you look at the actual, I can speak for hours why CORSIA is a very poor, let's say useless mechanism, mm-hmm. Especially when you look at the climate crisis that we're facing. Mm-hmm. There are two main reasons why it doesn't work, in principle and in practice. In principle, because since the Paris Agreement, everyone in every country, every sector of the economy needs to meet a temperature target. Mm-hmm. So everyone has to commit to a certain level of emission reduction. So there's really little space for offsetting like we had in the past with the Kyoto Protocol, for example, where it still allowed developed countries to buy some emission reductions from developing countries. Mm-hmm. And that's actually in that era that CORSIA's mechanism was, you know, developed and thought of. So it was pre-Paris Agreement era. And then the Paris Agreement came in and said, no, everyone has to commit to a temperature target. And so offsetting doesn't really have that much of a space in that, let's say, toolbox of climate mitigation.
Right, because it's about neutralizing emissions rather than getting rid of them, right?
Offsetting the growth is not getting down to zero.
No.
Definitely not. So that's the issue that we have with CORSIA in principle. And then in practice, there are also a number of issues with the kind of offsets that you're buying. One of the main reasons that the main characteristics of offsetting for it to work is that you have to make sure that the offset that you're buying actually, one, is permanent. So you can actually permanently delete a ton of CO2 that you're emitting. Mm-hmm. You have to avoid it being double counted in climate pledges. And most of the offsets that are being allowed under CORSIA programs don't meet all of these criteria. Mm-hmm. Especially when you look at nature-based offsets. So, for example, offsets that say, okay, you're going to plant a few trees here and there, mm-hmm. Or you're going to sell an avoidance offsets of deforestation. So you're going to basically say, I've avoided 3 trees being cut off this year, so I'm going to give you, 3 tons of CO2 worth of credit. Mm-hmm. Those are the kind of offsetting mechanisms that you have under CORSIA. And the issue is that now that we're facing, extreme weather, we're facing, drought, fires, hurricanes, how can you guarantee that the tree that you're planting is going to stay there and absorb the CO2 that you're emitting for all of the hundred of years that it's going to continue living in the atmosphere? So all in all, that's the issue we have. And then the last issue is that unfortunately it's regulated by a bunch of transport ministers. Mm-hmm. And so of course anything, and there's also a lot of, let's say corporate capture of this organization with industry bodies being there and lobbying their transport ministries to weaken the measures as much as possible. And you end up with a reduction of the baseline above which emissions now need to be mm-hmm. offset. And in total, you're going to end up in 2030 with only 22% of all international aviation emissions actually needing to be offset, mm-hmm. which is crazy when you think about it, when you're actually then, on the other hand, committing to reducing your emissions and getting to net zero. There's a form of like hypocrisy within mm-hmm. Within ICAO and transport ministries around CORSIA. Which unfortunately means that we can't really rely on an international body to regulate aviation emissions.
Hi everyone, Sam here again. Just wanted to remind you and maybe your colleagues as well that premium access to the pod and Foresight's brilliant journalism is just a click away. Try a subscription for 30 days for just €29. That gives you access to our website and audio app. Go to www.foresightdk.com/subscribe or follow the link in the show notes. Now, back to the show. It does seem a bit like building castles on sand. You know, there's putting a lot of faith, like you say, in these offsetting things where a forest fire can get rid of an entire, you know, decade of growth of aviation emissions or something. I mean, if we switch to something like emissions trading, for example, I mean, the EU emissions trading scheme includes aviation to an extent, intra-EU flights, correct me if I'm wrong with any of this, of course. International aviation was supposed to be included in the beginning, but that was lobbied out of it. But we are in this period of updating the ETS rules or things like, you know, the amount of permits that are included in the system, what should be regulated. Maritime is going to be included in the in the market for the first time. How are the rules regarding aviation changing? Are there positive developments in the works, or again, is not enough being done to actually bring down aviation emissions?
So I think the revision of the ETS that was proposed by the Commission in its Fit for 55 package was better than what existed before, but it's still, you know, not up for the challenge of addressing aviation's climate impact in total. I think the main issue that we faced with aviation in the ETS is that the ETS as a whole wasn't really effective to reduce aviation emissions, because the price of the ETS until, you know, 2018 or 2019 was still too low to incentivize any change. And I think it's only now that we're seeing the price of the ETS through revisions of the general ETS in the carbon market as a whole. We're seeing that impact trickle through the price of the ETS, which is positive, because that's the goal, is to make polluting more expensive so you can phase in cleaner alternatives. One of the issues as well that the ETS had when it came to aviation is that airlines received half of their emissions quotas for free. So they didn't need to buy and pay the full price tag of their pollution. And the final issue, and the biggest issue, is that it only addresses 40% of aviation's total emissions from Europe, because it only focuses on intra-EU flights. And that's something, unfortunately, that's been, you know, slightly swept under the carpet for a few decades, because everyone believes that long-haul flights, well, you know, they're international flights, so they need to be dealt with at international level. And we've already discussed why the international level is lacking in that regard. And we end up with a scheme, the ETS, that actually only addresses short-haul flights, not the ones that actually pollute the most. Because, as you know, if you fly long-haul, you consume more fossil fuel. And so you burn more fossil fuel, you produce more emissions. And long-haul flights is where most of the emissions come from. I think 6% of flights from Europe actually cause more than half of the emissions linked to burning kerosene. So in that sense, I think when we come to the revision, so the revision proposed by the Commission, you know, it was positive in one respect, because it reduced the amount of free allowances. It phased down the amount of free allowances that were going to give that were going to be given to airlines. But on the other hand, it was still only focusing on intra-EU and not addressing a part of long-haul flights departing from Europe. And this was a problem as well, because as part of this package, you also not only had the ETS, but you also had an initiative to mandate the use of sustainable aviation fuel. And that mandate actually applies for all departing flights. So on the one hand, the Commission was saying we can regulate the content of the fuel that we're going to sell all types of airlines leaving our territory. But on the other hand, it was saying, well, we're not going to price the emissions linked to the fuel that we're actually sending to these airlines, which is contradictory. You need both, especially to come down to zero. You need to make sure you phase out the use of fossil kerosene and that you phase in the use of sustainable alternatives. So that was the main issue with the ETS proposal. And the second one was linked to the fact that it ignored a big chunk of aviation's climate impact, which is linked to its non-CO2 effects. Now, non-CO2 effects are basically linked to some particle, some particulate matter that's emitted at a certain level of the atmosphere that causes contrails. And so these contrails have a warming effect that basically, let's say, is more important than the CO2 emissions alone. In total, scientists have shown that non-CO2 effects are actually two-thirds of aviation's total climate impact. And yet it was nowhere to be found in any of this, these regulations. So,
and the reason given for its exclusion, have they made it clear why it isn't included? There's not enough data? Or, I mean, you've already said there is enough data, but what was the reason?
Indeed. Indeed, I think there was this belief that there was still too much uncertainty because it's linked to, you know, climate models, climate calculations, because there is uncertainty because we don't really know exactly how or when non-CO2 effects are created, because it's really, it reacts depending on the weather, the humidity, the time of day. Not all flights have the same non-CO2 effects, and most of the non-CO2 effects happen on night flights, for example, over the atmosphere that's quite humid, when it's quite cold, because that's when the particulate matter freezes and creates these contrails. So of course, there was uncertainty concerning maybe where these effects happen, but the climate impact is known. And I think that changed over the past 2 years since the European Safety Agency published a report in 2020, I think, or 2021, where it showed and confirmed that actually non-CO2 effects are one of the biggest issues of aviation's climate problem. So now people understand a bit more that we need to deal with it, but regulators are always a bit, let's say, anxious of proposing legislation, but you know that there are loads of different options, which is also the beauty of non-CO2 effects. There are loads of different options you can use to try and reduce these effects. The first one being, of course, replacing the fuel, replacing kerosene by some cleaner alternative. So either by sustainable aviation fuels, so SAF, because SAF has less particulate matter, less, it creates less soot, so it doesn't create as many contrails and persistent contrails. But you can also lower the current aromatic level of kerosene. So kerosene at the moment, so if we follow, you know, regulation, aviation is still going to be at least 95% reliant on fossil-based fuels like kerosene. So how do we clean up kerosene by reducing the aromatics within that fuel to then basically have a positive impact on non-CO2 effects? And that's something that we're encouraging and that we hope, you know, the commission and governments will look into to try and regulate the quality of the kerosene that's being sold, because if you improve that, then you can reduce contrails.
I mean, if I just ask you about a few other policies that have made the, you know, various attractive headlines over the years, you know, banning private jets and banning certain short haul flight routes. Air France's bailout included certain provisions to get rid of some of their short haul flights, right? Maybe you could speak to the effectiveness of that and whether or not it's something that you think other airlines should mirror, and whether or not it's actually effective, or if it was not as as good as it sounded at first.
No, I think in general it's positive and encouraging to see some countries trying to push regulation of aviation emissions. Now, they don't use the best options always. I think so. If we go to banning short-haul flights. So indeed, Air France, the Air France bailout basically had some conditions around trying to shift domestic routes towards rail alternatives. But the rail journeys that would basically replace these flights would need to be under 2 hours and a half. And mm-hmm. when you put that limit, that's quite low, and then on top of that, exempt all of these hubbing flights. So all of the flights that basically connect airports to a hub to mm-hmm. then go on to an intercontinental flight. These would be excluded. If these were excluded, then you'd end up with actually addressing only 0.8% of French domestic emissions.
I see.
So the effectiveness of these measures are maybe political, you know, signaling that the aviation sector needs to change. But the effectiveness in terms of emissions is very limited. Mm-hmm. And that's not only because, you know, the policy in itself isn't done properly, but also because you're only focusing on short haul flights, which, as I said before, are only a small chunk of the problem.
Right, right. And on private jets as well, I think it was earlier this year, wasn't it? Emmanuel Macron or someone, I don't know if it was
Clément
just
Boone.
It was a cursory aside or if it was a serious policy about mm-hmm. looking into this. What's your take on that kind of policy?
So private jets, the private jets issue is much more interesting because, it's especially interesting at the moment when you see a huge divide between a handful of billionaires flying to go on holiday and the rest of us citizens trying to bear the cost of rising energy prices and, mm-hmm. Inflation overall. I think it's good that this topic is coming on top of the agenda of some policymakers at the moment, because we see the private jet sector as an opportunity to finance the decarbonization technologies for the rest of the aviation sector. Mm-hmm. Because first of all, most private jets and most private jet routes, especially in Europe, are under 500 kilometers. So they're very short haul flights between Paris and Nice, or Paris, Geneva, Geneva, Milan, Paris, London. I mean, these are all routes that can be replaced not only by a plane, by a commercial plane, but also by rail. Mm-hmm. Now, what we're saying is that it's difficult to consider banning these flights tomorrow, because if you ban them, then what are they going to do? They're going to fly maybe to other sunny destinations for holidays. Mm-hmm. So what we're suggesting is, first of all, making sure that they pay the full price of their pollution, which mm-hmm. is 10 times larger than anyone using a commercial flight. So you need to price those emissions more fairly, need to make sure that they contribute to public coffers to help governments also finance either decarbonizing aviation, but also in general, helping low-income families, dealing with energy crisis and all these things. But you need to make them to contribute to the fight against climate change as well. Mm-hmm. Paying a full tax on their kerosene, a tax on, you know, the use of private jets, the tickets that they're being sold, and then imposing a deadline and saying you have until 2030 to become zero emission. Mm-hmm. So forcing private jet users to say, well, it's either you continue flying but using zero emission technology, such as electric flights, hydrogen flights, because the first pilot projects of these flights are actually operating under 500 kilometers. So mm-hmm. the typical range that's being currently used by these private jets. And then also financing alternative sustainable fuels like e-fuels. So synthetic kerosene that is today, a technology that hasn't been deployed yet sufficiently because it's quite expensive. And I think that we should be asking private jet users to bear the upfront cost of deploying these very expensive technologies. Because mm-hmm. once you do that and you bring those technologies to the market, they become cheaper to use for the rest of the aviation industry. And so hopefully we can get them to benefit the rest of us and that we can maybe have a hope one day of flying mm-hmm. Without too much guilt.
I mean, if we could probably just sort of finalize the chat on technology. You mentioned all the different sort of options that are in play for aviation, running aircraft engines on 100% sustainable aviation fuel, mm-hmm. electric power, hydrogen. Every single week there seems to be a different kind of announcement about some startup fly in an electric plane, or you know, Airbus saying that they're going to develop a hydrogen airliner. But then you get that mitigated with other announcements where, you know, Airbus scrapped its electric flight program a couple of years ago because of COVID or something. What is your take on the seriousness that big companies like Airbus, Boeing, Embraer are approaching this? Will they need to be forced to really invest in these technologies? Are they just going to be, you know, nice things that they can put on PR packs for now? Or do you get the sense that they are starting to take this issue seriously? And, you know, like you say, the dream of having a guilt-free, emissionless flight could actually be feasible within a couple of years or longer.
Yeah. I think, I would hope that Airbus is serious about its plans, but let's say I'm an optimist, but a realist. And we know in the past that the only way to push these technologies to market is through regulation. And we need, as I said, to make polluting more expensive so we get a market or demand for these technologies. And then we need to mandate their use. Because we can't wait for Airbus to say, well, we're going to commit to hydrogen by 2035. And then it's going to be, oh, well, actually, it's going to be 2040 and then 2045. And in the meantime, airlines continue to burn kerosene and pollute our atmosphere. So I don't think that we should rely only on the industry. I think some parts of the industry are serious about trying to find solutions to continue existing because they see it as well. They understand the only way for them to continue having a license to fly is if they go green. But unfortunately, there's still a lot of resistance because also regulation-wise, we've been quite late. When you look at the road transport sector, one of the reasons why we have electric vehicles now booming is also because the EU imposed, let's say, tougher and tougher standards when it comes to CO2 efficiency of cars, to make sure that we phased out the internal combustion engine and phased in the electric vehicles. Now, of course, I'm not saying that we'll have an electric plane tomorrow, but I think we're quite late. If we had maybe 10 years ago already started pricing kerosene more fairly, imposing the use of zero emission technology, then we wouldn't be looking at the question in the way that we are today. So I think we need to make sure that regulation to mandate the use of sustainable aviation fuels, to mandate the use also of zero emission technology is key. But it has to go hand in hand with pricing kerosene more effectively, because if you continue having kerosene that's so cheap and produced in amounts that are, you know, limitless, you'll never change behavior. You'll never incentivize airlines to buy more expensive sustainable aviation fuel. And it's the same thing once hydrogen comes in and zero emission aircraft comes in. In order to use that, of course, airlines will have to bear the cost of it, but they need also some help or some obligation, some incentive. So you need a carrot and the stick, let's say. I think.
My final question, Joe, I mean, I guess on that point about, you know, the regulation is the stick and different incentives are the carrot. How, I mean, this is very difficult to predict, and we'd all be rich people if we could, but how does the current energy crisis affect aviation? Is that going to have a knock-on impact on kerosene, pushing the price up so, you know, zero emission options do become by default more attractive? Or do you think that the current situation will have not too much of an impact, shall we say, on this particular issue?
So I think, I mean, kerosene, the price of fuel has always fluctuated and it's always gone up and down and up and down. And when it's up, that's when you have like all of these more fuel efficient planes coming to the market, because airlines are pushed for economic reasons, not for environmental reasons, to invest in more efficient Boeings and Airbuses. You know, energy prices increasing, of course, will affect fossil fuel for airlines. But I think what's important with this energy crisis is to make sure that governments invest in renewable electricity. Because I think when we look at the ways of decarbonizing aviation in the next 20 to 30 years, we will need a lot of renewable electricity to be able to create synthetic fuels and synthetic kerosene. Because hydrogen planes and electric planes sure can maybe work on some short distances, as I said, but the long haul aviation or the long haul planes and jets will need a different type of sustainable aviation fuel that can be dropped in the engines. And that requires a lot of energy. And so I think it's really about renewable electricity, about green hydrogen being deployed at scale, reducing the cost of producing green energy, and then also investing in direct air capture. So making sure that the CO2 that we use to produce these fuels, these synthetic fuels, is from the atmosphere and not just, you know, taking point source from a fossil fuel industry somewhere and contributing to basically, you know, giving a new lifeline to a refinery. That's not the point. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So I think, you know, hopefully we'll get there, but I think we'll only get there if we invest in the renewable electricity we need. And maybe one final point I think we have to be also quite clear is that we cannot, especially with the energy crisis that we're facing now, we understand that we can't go to the same levels of growth that we've seen pre-COVID. Sorry. Mm-hmm. We can't sustain the same levels of growth and hope that we'll produce enough renewable electricity to fuel all of the demand. Mm-hmm. And something that we're encouraging companies to do, and some corporations are actually looking into this, is reducing the amount of corporate flying already to 50% below 2019 levels. I think this is, let's say, a low-hanging fruit that could be quite easy to reach, especially as we've seen during COVID, the use of Zoom and conferences online that we can attend instead of flying around, shaking a few hands, and then coming back and polluting on long-haul flights. So, and that's why, coming back to your point around other measures from, you know, flight bans or limiting the numbers of flights, like CO2 ceilings and CO2 caps in some member states, I think these are all options that need to be explored, because we need to manage the amount of flying that we're going to do in the next 10 to 15 years, because that's the only way we're going to reduce demand. Technology isn't going to save us in the next 10 to 15 years. We could put in place all of the pillars we need regulation-wise to make that happen in 10, 15 years. But in the meantime, we don't have electric planes. We don't have green hydrogen. No. We need to make sure that we manage demand in order to make sure that we can then decarbonize that demand. So it's really rationalize before you decarbonize. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we'll get there.
So many policies that all have to come good at the same time. It's the longer in this game, the longer that becomes clear. And also the longer, you know, I'm talking about energy and climate, the more it becomes clear that the more clean renewable electricity you produce, the easier these policies will be to implement.
And the less dependent you are on also, you know, questionable exactly. Dictatorships and governments.
Yeah, I think we're all starting to realize that finally. Joe, mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being on. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for talking all about aviation, which is, I think, a really important topic as we start this build up to COP and start to think about how countries can actually hit their climate goals and so on and so forth. So thank you for being on the Policy Dispatch.
Thank you, Sam. A pleasure to be here.
Clearly then, the obstacles to achieving green aviation and banishing Flugscam or flight guilt are numerous. Whatever policies regulators go for, aviation is likely to clash with other sectors for resources like fuel feedstocks and funding for charging infrastructure. So one would think that first movers stand to benefit greatly. As we heard from Joe Darden, there are plenty of vested interests standing in the way of the more ambitious policies, though. Now there's the small matter of this week's quiz. At the top of the show, I asked you, which country does aviation equal in terms of CO2 output? Brazil, Canada, or Germany? The correct answer was Brazil, at around 2.5%. Wow. Now, stay tuned to Foresight for more coverage in the coming months of transport issues and how they fit into the energy transition. And of course, check out Policy Dispatch's podcast, Older Sibling, What Matters, for even more insight and analysis. Check the website for details on how to access all of these amazing shows. Thank you once again for tuning into this week's episode, and until next time, goodbye for now.